Thank you for listening to the Spectator podcast. We've got a new offer. You can get a free Brexit butterfly mug, as well as 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/mug.
It was first pitched as a Valentine's Day massacre, but since then, we were under the impression today's cabinet reshuffle wasn't going to be the big fireworks that had first been imagined. How wrong that was. After sacking a handful of his ministers this morning, Boris Johnson met with his Chancellor Sajid Javid. However, the conversation did not go to plan. Around an hour later, Sajid Javid had handed in his notice as Chancellor, and quickly his successor was announced in Rishi Sunak. James, for those who have just tuned in, what's been going on?
So, over the last 10 days or so, there have been a kind of slew of stories in the paper quoting senior Treasury sources about everything from HS2 to supposed tensions between Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson's partner, Carrie Symonds. Boris Johnson had been getting increasingly personally irritated by these. Now, I think it's important to stress here that neither Boris Johnson nor Number 10 thought that Sajid Javid was doing this. They thought that people around him were. So when Sajid Javid came in to see Boris Johnson in Downing Street, and a sign that Number 10 did not expect this to be that difficult a conversation, or Boris Johnson didn't expect it to be that difficult a conversation, Boris Johnson said, we need to create a joint Number 10, Number 11 operation to stop these tensions. You know, what's the biggest single reason that British governments fail? That Number 10 and the Treasury fall out. So to stop that, I want to create this joint operation, and that's the only way we're going to end these stories. It is essentially what David Cameron and George Osborne would have done if they had won the general election in 2010 with a majority. And Sajid Javid said no. He thought that only being allowed to keep on one of his aides would have reduced him in stature and made him look like a kind of puppet chancellor. So Sajid Javid would not accept these terms. And so this reshuffle, which had previously been at the kind of middling end of a spectrum, has suddenly become massive. Because Number 10 then accepted Sajid Javid's resignation, and the Chief Secretary of Treasury, Rishi Sunak, is going to become the Chancellor, and you are going to have this joint Number 10, Number 11 operation. Now, I think there are two very significant things about this. First of all, there will be no alternative power centre in government now. You're going to have Number 10 and the Treasury yoked together, and that means essentially that no other department will be able to resist that. And then I think an underappreciated fact is that Rishi Sunak was a Brexiteer. You know, came out for Vote Leave as a new MP. And I think that means that even as the end of a transition period approaches and tensions very possibly really rise in the negotiations, Number 10 and the Treasury are going to stay on the same page in terms of negotiating strategy for the trade deal. I think those people thinking that the Treasury might push for a softer line, you know, whatever the institutional Treasury's views, you're not going to see that now.
Now, before we look ahead to what this means for Number 10 and Number 11 going forward, let's look back. Sajid Javid now will go down as one of the shortest serving chancellors. Fraser, what are you picking up in terms of the events that occurred today and previously? There have been reports of disquiet between the two teams for some time.
Oh yeah, sure there have. But then again, counterbalanced with warmth between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. I mean, Sajid Javid had his 50th birthday a few weeks ago, a few days after the general election. And there were about 250 guests, hardly anybody, any politicians there. And the idea was that he would only invite his personal friends. Boris Johnson was there and Carrie Symonds as well. Now, the two of them have always got on well. They only had one policy disagreement, and that was over Boris's spending levels. He wanted to spend more, make more spending promises in the manifesto than Sajid Javid did. And in the end, a fairly easy truce was brokered by Isaac Levidou, the campaign chief. But when it came to the big things about borrowing for infrastructure, HS2, there wasn't a single thing, as far as I understand, that Sajid Javid was holding back Boris Johnson from doing. But this was all about the modus operandi. How should you run your department? Under the British system, a Chancellor of the Exchequer has always been an incredibly powerful job. Effectively, it's the number two job. It's not just the finance minister, as it is in lots of other European countries. This is somebody who's got operational control of the government. Now, Gordon Brown used these tools to basically make himself chief executive of the government to Tony Blair's chairman. David Cameron and George Osborne worked alongside each other, but didn't really change the powers and the tools. What happened here is that Dominic Cummings, who supports Johnson's chief advisor, has always wanted to downgrade the power of the Treasury. He didn't like the idea of there being another massive power base in government. He thought it was pointless having these tensions and arguments. And so Dominic Cummings saw the briefing wars as basically a sign of tension to come between number 10 and number 11. So it was his idea to put in a merged team. Now, so when Sajid Javid's conversation today, he was asked to be the first one to turn up. He wanted to be, the idea was he'd be the first person to be reappointed, because during the campaign, the Prime Minister has said, look, Sajid Javid's going to stay, he's going to be my man, he's going to do a budget in March. All of that was set. So they have a conversation which, as I understand it, went on pretty favourable lines, all the things that they were doing that the Prime Minister was happy with, and then dropped in at the end, by the way, the advisor teams are going to have to change. Now, that was, to Sajid Javid, a deal-breaker. He saw it not just, say, as a question of who the advisors are going to be, but basically whether he is trusted to run his own show. Without his own special advisors, if he has to run with basically a team of minders from number 10 beneath him the whole time, he didn't feel that he would be chancellor, and he thought he would be living up to that rather unkind phrase used in the press by him, Chino, chancellor in name only. He thought that was about to become real. The deal was that what Boris was effectively saying was, you can stay as chancellor, but only on my terms and with number 10 seizing the levers of power. Now, for him, that was a red line. He thought this earlier before he went in, because there had been speculation that Boris Johnson would do this. Sajid Javid didn't think it was likely, because he knew he'd have to quit. Here's the big question. Did number 10 game this as well? Did number 10 think that Sajid Javid will quit over this, and that's a trade we're willing to make? Because as I understand it, Sajid Javid made it very clear, it's basically either me or Dominic Cummings. That was the sort of way that he'd say that, I am not prepared to go down this route that Dominic Cummings wants. So either you keep me in your government, or you do things his way. And in the end, Boris Johnson chose to do it Dominic Cummings' way.
Now, all the evidence so far suggests that Boris Johnson wanted Sajid Javid to stay on as chancellor as long as he agreed to the terms. But Fraser touches on perhaps another curious possibility in all this, which is, we know that Sajid Javid had a better relationship with the inhabitants of the apartment, so Boris Johnson and his partner, than he did the number 10 staff, figures like Dominic Cummings. James, do you think that, in a way, this outcome, which means that Rishi Sunak is now going to be the Chancellor, someone who we know gets on better with lots of the number 10 team, is in a way this a preferable outcome to some figures in number 10?
I think there certainly will be people in number 10 who aren't shedding any tears tonight that Sajid Javid has departed. I think Fraser's analysis is right, that I think Boris Johnson thought that Sajid Javid would go along with this. And it is worth remembering that Boris Johnson is, this might seem a very odd thing to say about a Prime Minister, but Boris Johnson is not as Westminster attuned, if you see what I mean, as many. And so I wonder whether he realised quite what a big demand this would be. And I think Boris Johnson's view would have been, you know, we want our teams to work together, so what's the issue here? And I think, you know, Sajid Javid obviously saw this as a you know, massive encroachment on his turf. And whilst I don't think Boris Johnson saw it like that, but I don't think it is undoubtedly true that there will be various people in number 10 tonight who will not be sobbing into their pillows. And, you know, but also I think, you know, I mean, it is another remarkable development, in that if you consider how, you know, Sajid Javid, you know, was very confident that, you know, that his relationship with Boris Johnson, you know, their dogs do their business at the same time in the morning and all that stuff, would carry him through. It obviously has not.
The other thing is, I think that Boris thought his powers of persuasion would prevail here, that he'd use his charm. And you can actually see the argument. Think, look, it's just a couple of advisors, right? You're Chancellor of the Exchequer, you can command all of these civil servants. All we're talking about here is two relatively low advisors. So is it really worth walking away from the second greatest job in Britain? Well, the first being editor of Spectator, of course.
I think it's also worth remembering this. It is another reminder of how Blair Brown has left such an impression on people. You know, number 10 talk about this as a desire to create a kind of, you know, a Cameron Osborne style relationship. You know, they are determined to avoid a repeat of, you know, number 10 and the Treasury clashing, nothing getting done as a result of that. And I think, you know, I think Boris Johnson kind of sees, you know, what's the problem with this? Why would you object? You know, why would you object to us working more closely together?
But Fraser, on that, people are talking about David Cameron, George Osborne, and how this could be a new creation if you look at Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak. But if you look at the events that have led up to today and Sajid Javid deciding to step down, it's ultimately been there's been a sense and a narrative that Number 10 have increasingly taken powers away from the Treasury. And there were points when it was more like the Number 10 aides were writing the budget than those in the Treasury. So in a way, now that they're going to have this system in place of centralised power and special advisers, are we actually looking at a joint enterprise in terms of the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, or is it actually going to be Number 10 calling the shots?
I think it's going to be Number 10 calling the shots. Now, in the Osborne-Cameron years, there's a reason, right, why Number 10 and Number 11 are the homes of a Chancellor and the Prime Minister, because those two offices are so powerful that obviously the two guys in those offices have got to get along, work as a complete team. But they do that while having power over their own respective offices. And that's the way that Sajid Javid wanted to do it. He thought, look, let's just work closely together. We can have as many meetings as you want, but I still want to have power of control. I don't want to be told what to do by advisors that pick by you. So this is also takes us to a very interesting question about this whole reshuffle. Is this a cabinet government? In other words, is this one where the Prime Minister picks powerful cabinet members who come up with their own agenda? Or is this a government where Number 10 decides what to do and gives cabinet members instructions to carry out? At the moment, it's looking more like the latter. Now, I'm not saying either of these models is better than the other. It depends on the quality of the advice. Tony Blair had a sort of Napoleonic, very strong Number 10 model. David Cameron, because of coalition, had a very devolved model. Theresa May had a sort of system of terror where her two advisors, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, would order everybody else around. And Sajid Javid in particular rebelled against that. He hated it. And he reproved Theresa May for it after the election, saying, I never want to be treated that way again. He is not the sort of person that likes to be given instruction or direction by somebody who isn't elected. Some people get more sensitive about that than others. But as far as Sajid Javid's concerned, what Boris was suggesting wasn't just an affront to him, it was an affront to the British system of government.
James, I suppose the counter is Number 10 have often praised Rishi Sunak. They've found him easier to work with at times than Sajid Javid. So if they now have someone they trust more, does that mean it's going to be a more even relationship?
I think if you look back, I think Cameron Osborne is a very interesting model, because Cameron was undoubtedly, you know, the leader on that one. You know, that on big calls, you know, when Cameron Osborne disagreed in private, Cameron won out. But I think anyone looking back on that Cameron government wouldn't think that George Osborne didn't have any influence. You know, a huge amount of stuff was done by him. And so I think this is the kind of question, which is, you know, if you have two teams that trust each other, does that actually involve more compromise? I mean, one of the things that Number 10 was so neuralgic about the HS2 briefing was they didn't like this idea of things being chalked up as a win for this person or a win for that person. They kind of took issue with that. But, you know, I think the proof of this pudding will be in the eating, right? So what happens in the budget? What happens in the spending review? And, you know, what happens with Brexit? You know, in the trade deal, you know, where does the Treasury stand on all that stuff? You know, that, I think, in a way, as Janelle Lair said about the French student protest, but sadly we all thought it was about the French Revolution, you know, it is too early to tell whether this will work or not. But it is interesting in that one of the other things it means is that departments have traditionally tried to kind of play off Number 10 and the Treasury against each other. They won't be able to do that now. So this not only this is a massive centralisation of power, because you've now basically got the Treasury and the Cabinet Office, the two most powerful departments in government, yoked together.
Now, this news has overtaken all other cabinet reshuffle news, but there have been other comings and goings, and in the shape of this morning, Boris Johnson sacked five of his cabinet ministers, and that included Julian Smith. Fraser, it wasn't so long ago he won Minister of the Year at Spectator Parliamentarian of the Year Awards, which clearly isn't a curse, but it does touch on the fact that this is, to some, surprising because of Julian Smith's work breaking the deadlock at Stormont.
Yes, and you know, what he did in Northern Ireland was incredible. He was praised by the Prime Minister for that, and it all went reasonably well. But There's something else that Julian Smith did, and that's he almost resigned when it came to the Brexit talks. He was regarded, basically, as being a bit of a wobbler. He didn't quite wobble, but he was seriously thinking about it, and he thought about it for long enough to put some doubts about his loyalty in the mind of the Prime Minister. He knew that. He knew he was going to have to walk the plank. And part of the reason that we gave him Minister of the Year award was because people did think that his basically card was marked. There aren't that many ministers who have achieved much in the last 12 months. I think his achievement to get devolution back up and running in Northern Ireland was probably the single greatest ministerial achievement of the last 12 months is not saying much. He deserved the award, but I do also see why Boris Johnson thought that he wanted people he could completely rely on, because let's not forget, we might be looking at a no deal Brexit at the end of this year. We might be looking at Michel Barnier and Boris Johnson not coming to terms. And in that case, the last thing Boris wants is somebody likely to resign from his cabinet. So that's a mistake which was made with Amber Rudd, and it's a mistake he doesn't want to repeat.
James, if we look at the various cabinet ministers who were forced to resign or sacked, you have Geoffrey Cox, Andrea Leadsom, Esther McVeigh, Theresa Villiers, and, as we just mentioned, Julian Smith. What do they all have in common, and what do they reveal about the thinking behind this reshuffle?
So my very bad joke this morning was that this is the morning of the long memories, because nearly everyone is someone who's crossed them. As Fraser said, Julian Smith was clearly on the verge of resigning as things got very hairy in the autumn. I think Boris Johnson has a long-standing worry about Geoffrey Cox. You know, I don't think any Prime Minister is going to be entirely comfortable with an Attorney General who named his chambers after Thomas More, the man who famously went to the block rather than follow the King's lead. Andrea Leadsom, I don't think Boris Johnson has got over the fact that she got 11 votes in the leadership contest and then basically wanted a great office of state from him as a condition for supporting him. I think he was kind of incredulous about that. Theresa Villiers didn't back Boris Johnson's Brexit deal when he first came back of it until the morning of that Saturday sitting, which we all remember it turned into a farce, but you know, then I think that what number 10 want is loyalty, discipline, and competence. I think that those are, you know, you've got to tick all three of those boxes in this reshuffle. And if you look at the people they're promoting, you know, for example, Anne-Marie Trevelyan, you know, in Dominic Cummings's various blogs about the Vote Leave campaign, he wasn't polite about many MPs, but Anne-Marie Trevelyan was one of them. And then when Boris Johnson was running in the parliamentary stages of his leadership contest, you know, Anne-Marie Trevelyan was one of his whips. She was very effective at getting people to sign up to his campaign. And I think what you see there is a competent, loyal soldier kind of rewarded. And I think this is a reshuffle which is about basically saying you've got to be on the same page as number 10. We're not going to have little bastions of rival power bases across Whitehall.
So loyalty, what was it?
Loyalty, discipline, and competence, LDC.
Right, but the greatest of these is loyalty.
Loyalty trumps all. I suspect this may be a two-podcast kind of day, so we'll be back once we have all the new appointments to discuss. Fraser, just before we end this one, there was quite a lot of talk ahead of the reshuffle that Liz Truss could be in trouble. I had someone tell me that one of the phrases to be using in Whitehall, this would be take out the Truss day. But in truth, she stayed in position and she hasn't actually been moved
from her
brief. She's
now the longest serving cabinet minister.
She is the longest serving cabinet minister, as James points out. I was definitely going to say that. And she is the international trade secretary. So it's a victory for Truss.
Well, to survive is victory. It's like Dunkirk, really. And this is more than the Chancellor has managed to do. Yeah, but we're also told that there might not be many reshuffles, so she might be even longer serving international business secretary. And also, her department was supposed to be rolled up into something else. And so yeah, I'm a big fan of hers. I think she makes government more interesting. She's very good at articulating why people should vote Conservative, which I have to say isn't being done brilliantly at the moment. So long may she continue her glorious Instagram cabinet career.
I think one of the other things about this is she was the first cabinet level minister to back Boris Johnson, and I think he has not forgotten that. I think some others around him might have done, but I think he personally has it there.
And Jacob Rees-Mogg also still in place, and he was the first MP to back him, again coming back to loyalty being the greatest rewarded trait.
And then I think the other thing I would say about Liz Truss, which is I think there is a kind of weird thing, which is number 10 don't like, as you yourself have pointed out, Katie, many times, the number 10 don't like media showboating. But there is also another thing, which is if you are the International Trade Secretary, part of your job is to go and promote the UK. And so there is a kind of, there is a fine line. And I always thought that she was cut slightly more slack on some of that stuff than other people, because some of the kind of cheesy photo ops in various places around the world, you know, might have been a bit cringeworthy, but they also were effective at getting various, you know, newspaper coverage in those countries for her visit.
Yeah, it's fun. She's a fun cabinet member. We need more of them.
And if you want to hear more from that fun cabinet member, we have not one but two episodes of Women Balls for Liz Truss.
That's how much balls she's got.
She might be a third at this rate. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/balls. Thank you, Fraser, and thank you, James.